Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. The Capital Connection this week with Blair Horner. He is the Senior Policy Advisor for NYPIRG. You can find out more at NYPIRG.org. In the interest of full disclosure, Blair also does commentary for WAMC, serves on our Board of Trustees, and we love him. And he's back again. Welcome, Blair.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Blair, I listened to your recent commentary on WAMC, and you were talking about the big, beautiful bill. But just because it's in Washington doesn't mean that every state in the nation, including New York, isn't going to be impacted by what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the congressional legislation that I was describing in the my commentary, the big, beautiful bill, which is what the president has described it as, it passed the House, but the Senate hasn't dealt with it yet. So we don't really know what's going to happen. But if the House version becomes more or less what ultimately happens, it's going to have big impacts in New York and, as you mentioned, every other state in the country, primarily because of the cuts to things like the Medicaid program. The Medicaid program provides health insurance for low and moderate income individuals who otherwise can't afford to have help to get pay for health insurance or don't have it provided through their employer. And it's a big number. New York's roughly a quarter to a third of the population is covered by Medicaid. And according to the Congressional Budget Office, if the House version of the big, beautiful bill actually becomes law, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10, 11 million Americans will lose their health insurance. And a chunk of those will be in New York. So it will have a dramatic impact on the lives of New Yorkers, and it could have profound impacts on the state budget that was just recently wrapped up last month.
Blair Horner, you are a politically astute individual, and you understand the idea of what a constituency and representing a constituency means. And why I say that is because these cuts are not only going to affect Democrats, but Republicans. And you'd never want to tick off your base. And I'm wondering if you believe that that could potentially happen because of these cuts.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I hedged so much, you know, just a minute ago, because the senators the congressional senators, who deal with now the big, beautiful bill, that they have to come up with their version and then they have to reconcile the differences. A lot of those senators are Republicans, and Republicans have a majority, and they are, you know, unhappy with the cuts because it will have big impacts in their states, their home states. And so it's not entirely clear how this is all going to work out. I mean, the basic framework for what the big, beautiful bill will look like is, big cuts, as I mentioned, but also huge tax cuts, primarily targeting the wealthy. And so the basic thrust of my argument that I made was that, you know, the nation, the United States, has tremendous levels now of debt that's piled up largely due to tax cuts and also the spending on the pandemic. And it's reached historically high levels. The United States now has, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. And if you get to a point where the spending on the interest on your debt is greater than the sort of the growth of the economy, that's when great powers end up in sort of a death spiral, financial death spiral. That's what happened to Great Britain, for example. And so, you know, you don't want to do that. And that's so the undercurrent is, well, what do you do in this process to both to reduce the debt and to fulfill the president's, you know, campaign wishes? And it can't be done. It basically can't be done. You can't do massive tax cuts and cuts to popular programs and expect it to pass the Congress. And so I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen. My argument was, well, let's make the wealthy feel the pain that the poor are going to feel because of the cuts to programs by not giving them additional tax cuts. I mean, after the last time the United States had gigantic debt levels was after World War II, which, of course, made sense, right? We were fighting a war. And what the nation did is they raised the tax rates to, you know, the highest levels ever. as a way to help pay down the debt. And they ultimately did by the mid-1970s, instead of having, you know, as I mentioned, the 100% of debt to gross domestic product levels, they got it down to 25%. And it's been going up ever since because of tax cuts that primarily benefit the wealthy. So I think that's what has to be done. You have to say no tax cuts and let's see what we can do. And so, again, I'm sort of circling, you know, around your question, but there's a fundamental disconnect in terms of what the problem is that the nation faces and what the Congress and the president want to do.
Well, Blair Horner, senior policy advisor for NYPERG, I am just miffed at the idea that traditional Republican values would have it that we don't raise the debt. And yet this Republican Party right now doesn't seem like the normal Republican Party I was used to most of my life.
Well, you're getting to be an old goat, David, and that is, you know, political parties change. You know, I mean, in the Civil War, the Republicans were the champions of civil rights. And in the early the turn of the century, around 1900, they were the champion of progressivism. It starts to change in, you know, the 1930s, where the Democrats become the champions of civil rights. And that's the way it sort of plays out into the 60s. Political parties change. The Republican Party is not that party anymore. And it is more a party aligned with the sort of populism that is articulated by the president. And it's the traditional values of balanced budgets, you know, muscular foreign policy. That's not where their heads are at.
But Blair, do the majority of the American people get that, or are they still stuck in the traditional understandings of party? It's just so knee-jerk. My parents were Republicans. I'm a Republican, for the most part.
Yeah, well, you know, things change. The world changes. You got to deal with it.
I don't
it,
right? like that.
Well, it is what it is. And, you know, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, so, you know, I've observed this from the sidelines. But the, you know, the construct, the coalitions now that underpin the Republican Democratic parties have been changing. And on the Republican side, the changing really sort of is more of a populist message, which is, and there's a critique that's legitimate, I think, on their part, which is all these great trade deals that allowed multinational corporations to prosper and for elites to prosper have not helped working people in America. And therefore, something should be done. And that answer, according to President Trump, is tariffs. Now, you can argue that that's good or bad idea, but that is the underpinning for the critique is that. And so that is a different sort of message than sort of the, you know, not even Reagan, right? I mean, at a certain level, Reagan articulated a muscular foreign policy, which was true then, and it's not the same now, but he ran up the debt. And despite all of the things he said about the need for balanced budgets, that's when the debt starts to take off in the United States. So it's, you know, I mean, parties change. The public will come to understand it more and more over time. And then you'll see what happens after that.
Well, and what happens after the big, beautiful bill, if it should go completely through and the cuts are realized, you know, that is going to impact the New York State Legislature. I'm guessing they're going to be back to deal with this.
Well, you're right. I mean, in the state budget, and by the way, just so that your listeners know, I mean, this big, beautiful, whatever it turns out to be, it could be a big, ugly bill. Who knows, right? That's going to take time for it to play out. And the Senate is saying that they're going to put together their reconciliation package by July 4th weekend. Now, it's not clear they're going to make that deadline, but that's what they're trying to do. And then you have to reconcile the differences between the two houses. And so you're really looking at probably the end of July before, you know, an optimistically, reasonably optimistic view about when they'll get the proposal done. So that means, you know, if the New York State Legislature had to sort of figure out what to do, it's not going to happen until the fall or late summer, you know, September, October. And so then you're starting to get into next fiscal year. But I wanted to set up sort of the timetable. I don't think anything has to happen right away. In the budget, in the state budget that passed in May, the legislature granted the governor authority to basically not spend money depending on what happens. And so it's possible that the governor and the legislature could kick the can past the beginning of 2026 and then deal with whatever problems existed in the debate over next fiscal year state budget, which is April 1st. And so it's possible they'll come back. It's also possible, depending on what happens, they may not have to come back. Your basic point, though, that the way they're describing what they're going to do in the Congress, which is to basically savage programs that the poor and the needy rely on while giving tax cuts to essentially the wealthiest people in the country, is the way they're going. And not only is it unfair to America, in my opinion, and doesn't solve the problem that they say they're trying to solve, it creates problems in New York State, as well as the other 49 states, in terms of whatever their fiscal houses are in order there. And it could mean that next year's state budget could be a difficult one because it may have to deal with a significant deficit.
Yeah, and of course, the cuts that have been happening aren't just cuts of future money. They've been holding back already allocated funding. I'm thinking of environmental funding. I'm even thinking of funding for public media. And that is really making it hard for these organizations not only to plan, but to survive.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the programs that the Congress is talking about savaging are ones that were really sort of touted by former President Biden as achievements. And so it's sort of this narrow, you could argue, depending how you look at it, that it's really just partisan-driven, ideologically-driven, and harmful to the vast majority of Americans. Now, whether or not the vast majority of Americans can sort of cut through the fog of propaganda, that's a whole other issue. But the critique, which I talked about just before, that the nation faces a staggering level of debt is actually true. But as a society, we're all supposed to rise and fall together, right? So the articulation of the debt problem, again, is real. But the solution, in fact, that they're proposing in Congress will make it worse. And in fact, savages the programs that low-income, middle-income Americans rely on, depending how you look at the issues, and benefits the wealthy that don't need it. And so it's really wrong-headed. And so the other way to look at it is it's just a cynical way to use a real issue to drive an ideological agenda where the vast majority of Americans suffer and hope that you can blunt any political blowback through propaganda. And that's, you know, that's the various social media platforms, some of the mainstream media, where they just make up stuff hope to bamboozle people into thinking that, you know, what's good is what's bad is actually good. And that's why you need things like you mentioned public media. Public broadcasting is one of the few places that the public can go to actually get real information. And that's one of the reasons why they want to get rid of it. Or get rid of federal funding for it.
And of course, we are somewhat biased in that this is a public radio station and public stations air this program. And of course, Blair, you are a commentator here. But nonetheless, when you have people in Congress and hearings calling public broadcasting anti-American in that they believe that our reporting is biased, I mean, in a sense, what they're really attacking is free speech. And I would argue that we're not biased. We practice the journalism of verification, and we try to get to the truth and report it fully. We act independently. We try to minimize harm. But in the end, it's free speech. We need to have different voices, and we need to have civil conversations. And as you said, it seems they're taking a cynical approach. And let me just add, Blair, that I think there's been a classic battle in this country with our values. We have the I, right? The individual and the individual's achievement. But the truth is no individual succeeds alone. This idea of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Nobody does it alone. And in fact, I don't think it's automatic that people think we're all in this together because that's not coming from this administration. Only certain people matter. So we've had a classic back and forth tension between the I and the we of America.
David, I should be asking you a question.
Shoot, go ahead.
No, I mean, I agree, but just to even take it one step further, I think that there's sort of a widespread assault on what the nation's founding document is all about. So you mentioned freedom of the press. That's in the United States Constitution.
Bill of Rights.
Freedom of speech, that's in the Constitution. You're supposed to have due process rights before you get hauled off to some prison in a foreign country. And so there are things that I think Americans need to remember. When presidents swear in their oath, they swear loyalty to the Constitution of the United States. so do our members of the armed forces, so do all of our elected officials. And so it's, I think people forget or don't know enough about what are sort of the constitutional underpinnings of this society. And, you know, that has been part of the propaganda. And I think the American version of propaganda has been extremely successful for those who promote it, because the wealth of the nation, the wealthiest members of the nation, by and large, ascribe to the view that you just articulated, which is about it's all about I, not the we. But you're right. I mean, you can't become a billionaire in the United States if there's no armed forces to defend you from foreign invaders. You can't become a successful professional without a higher education system to educate you. And largely that's funded through public monies. You can't understand what's happening in the world unless you have a free functioning fourth estate. So there's lots of things that are changing. Most, depending how you look at it, I suppose, good or bad. And they are a lot of, problems are not being solved or should be solved. But I think it's important for people to remember that the Constitution is actually the foundation document. And there are things in it that are currently, unfortunately, being ignored.
He is Blair Horner, the senior policy advisor for NYPIRG. You are listening to The Capital Connection. I'm David Gustina. Well, let's focus in on one of these bills, the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. It passed the Senate. It's in the Assembly. I know you've supported this. What do you think?
Well, just to put it in some context for the listeners, I mean, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation put out a report in December 2023. It was called a Solid Waste Management Plan. And in that, they describe the problem that's the state of New York is facing when it comes to disposing of municipal solid waste. Landfills are filling up. You can't build more incinerators because they burn things. Burn things lead to greenhouse gas emissions. And so what should you do? And the DEC says the New York, and the rest of the country certainly, but certainly New York, has to move to what's called a circular economy, where the waste that's produced is the responsibility largely of those who produce the packaging waste. And so the bill that you're describing, the packaging bill, is a way to do that, is a way to encourage recycling, reduce the use of toxics in packaging, and to reduce the burden on New York State's municipal solid waste system. And so the legislation, as you and I are talking now, you're right, it's passed the Senate. It's now, like hand-to-hand combat on the floor of the Assembly. Yeah. We don't know how that's going to work out yet. But we believe we have the votes, and we certainly believe that we have the rationale that makes sense as to why it's needed.
Well, and Blair, you must like the idea, because we don't often see this. You know, they pass these sort of mandates or laws, and then they don't have any enforcement. I see they're going to establish, if it passes, a new Office of Inspector General to ensure the companies fully comply.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of the basic philosophic underpinning of the legislation is that the companies will be responsible for the waste, and the companies will have a lot of latitude to figure out how to comply, because, we're talking about all different kinds of packaging. But to make sure that there's public accountability, there would be an entity established by the government to monitor what they're doing and to make sure that they're meeting the goals that are set in the bill, as well as that they're behaving in a way that's not just enriching themselves at the expense of the public.
Which, Blair, is exactly what's happening on the national level. The Trump administration is getting rid of regulations in every possible spot.
Well, and they fired all the inspector generals. So at the federal level, again, there's a huge difference between what the state of New York talks about doing and does and what the federal the federal government is debating and does. It's a huge, the gap couldn't be wider. So that being said, Americans will get a chance to vote on that in 2026, what they think about what's happening in Washington, and they will get a chance to vote on what they see in New York come 2026 when they see how that's all happening. That's what elections are for. And so, we'll see what Americans want to do. We'll see what New Yorkers want to do in those elections. But it's a huge difference. There's no doubt about it. And the sort of like the federal approach of punishing alternative energy sources like wind and solar, and trying to reinvigorate fossil fuel power like coal and oil is based on a false analysis that says that there's no such thing as climate change, which is just ridiculous. Now, New York State has
not only ridiculous, it's an all out lie.
Well, yeah, it's ridiculous and it is a lie. Yes, that's right. I mean, it is. There's no, you can measure temperature. We have conquered the thermostat. And we know that the planet is getting hotter. There's no getting around it. And the world's experts all talk about why. The industry's known for 50 years why it was going to happen. So you got to do something about it. Trump administration, the Congress doesn't want to do anything about it. They want to stick their head in the sand, which will accelerate catastrophe. In New York, we have laws in the books, and sometimes it's dragging their feet, but there's laws in the books to try to deal with it. Hopefully, sanity will reign. Hopefully, reliance on science will come back, and maybe we can sort of mitigate the looming and ongoing climate catastrophe that we're all facing. We're on that right now, breathing in, smoke from Canadian wildfires. Yeah. And some of that, of course, is, forest management and everything else. But a lot of it is because it's super dry. And when it's super dry, all it takes is a spark and you got a big fire.
No question about it.
And the reason it's super dry is because of climate change.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of, as you said, New York has a lot of legislation to this end, trying to deal with it, like the HEAT Act. Now, this seems to be the toughest one to me. It's been rebranded. It's called the Customer Savings and Reliability Act. It's been updated. And this is Senator Liz Krueger, who is one of the sponsors on this. But, the idea that with all Democrats in power, that some of these things still have a rough road.
Well, the opposition's different depending on the bill. So the HEAT Act, the opposition was not just the fossil fuel industry, but it was some labor unions that rely on the jobs of the particular things like pipe fitters who connect natural gas mains to people's houses. And so the law, the proposal in New York HEAT is basically one of the main things was, well, we're not going to just heat hook up people's homes to gas mains for free for the person. But the ratepayers would have to pick up to the tune of $200 million, the costs of connecting people's homes, because it doesn't make any sense to keep building fossil fuel infrastructure in a world where you're trying to move toward non-fossil fuel power. But, if you're a pipe fitter, you're like, well, you're talking about me, right? I need work. And so you have often on some of these climate issues, a different kind of opposition. That doesn't mean that all labor views it that way. I mean, there are certainly labor unions that are in support of the New York HEAT Act. But so it's the mix of concerns is different. And the fossil fuel industry has so much money. They spread it all over the place to build coalitions and opposition to anything on climate. So, and that's what makes it harder. I mean, it's about money versus the public interest, which plays out not only on climate issues, but on issues all across the board.
One of the other issues to deal with climate and also to help pay the MTA is congestion pricing. You and I have talked about this. So far what I've seen from reports, some with data and others more anecdotal, is that it's working, that we're seeing less traffic and congestion in Manhattan and wait times are going down. But there has been a big fight over it, including the Trump administration trying to kill it. I don't even know at this point because there was a deadline. They kept extending it. There was supposed to be another deadline. But again, this idea that any move New York makes in these environmental areas seems to get the ire of the federal government.
That's right. I mean, it's an ideological opposition to anything that smacks of green, meaning green environmental issues. Congestion pricing, we knew would work. I mean, it's not like this is the first time it's ever been done. There are cities all around the world that do it. And not only does it do all the things you just described, which is really to sort of reduce the congestion in lower Manhattan, most of Manhattan, it also generates money to pay for the mass transit system and to improve it. And the funding of the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which provides the mass transit systems in the greater New York area, that costs money. And this is a huge percentage of the money that the MTA has, and it provides a revenue source for them to do bonding for various capital projects. And so it's critical to the lifeblood of the city. New York City cannot function without a good mass transit system. It doesn't have to be great, but it certainly has to be good. The Trump administration's opposition is, my guess, is both a combination of, you know, sort of being allergic to anything that smacks of helping, of having an environmental component, and also to create leverage to, you know, be able to pressure New York state government to do something else on maybe an unrelated issue. We saw that play out where the Trump administration sort of made up a concern about wind farms off of New York, off of Long Island. And the wind farms had already passed all the various things. They had all their permits. They're in the construction process. The Trump administration holds that up. And then recently we've seen that with some sort of agreement that we're not even sure what it is, that if New York State takes a second look at various fossil fuel pipeline deals that would run through New York State, that the Trump administration would lift its opposition to wind. Now, again, we don't know how that's all going to play out other than the wind farm is going to be built. But that's the kind of thing where sometimes it's about leverage and it's really not even about the issue.
Well, that's it, Blair. We're out of time. It went quick today. Wow. Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for NYPIRG. That's the New York Public Interest Research Group. You can find out more at NYPIRG, NYPIRG.org. Blair, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, David.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.